Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. On Saturday, the Ohioana Library Association celebrates Ohio authors with the 2010 Ohioana Book Festival. Three of the featured authors for the event are with us today. My guests today are authors Angela Johnson. She's an Ohioana award-winning author of novels and poems for children. She has won many other writing awards as well, including three times for the American Library Association's Coretta Scott King Award. Angela was born in Alabama and grew up in Windham, Ohio. She now lives in Kent, Ohio. Welcome to the show, Angela.
Thank you. Thank you a lot.
David Catro lives in Springfield with his wife and their dogs, Beetle, Blue, and Bubs. Bubs is the inspiration for his latest series of books, which he wrote, has written, and illustrated. It's called, well, the book I read is called Dinosaur Hunt. The latest is called Funny Lunch, and they star Max the Spaniel. David has twice been honored by the New York Times with the Best Illustrated Book of the Year Award. He's a former syndicated editorial cartoonist with his work published in more than 900 newspapers. Wow. Welcome to the show, David.
Hello.
And Andrew Hudgens is a humanities distinguished professor in English at OSU. He is the 2010 recipient of the Governor's Award for the Arts in Ohio for his poetry. He is a past nominee for both the Pulitzer Prize and the National Book Award. He was born in Texas, but has mentored two generations of poets at the University of Cincinnati and OSU. Welcome to the show, Andrew.
My pleasure.
I guess it's always good, since it's the Ohioana Festival, to talk about your Ohio roots and how they began and when they were set down. So, Andrew, why don't we begin with you?
Well, I'm one of those. My dad was a military brat, so I'm kind of one of those people that moved around, and it's hard to kind of answer the question, where's your home? But I've lived in Ohio for 30 years now, teaching at Cincinnati and Ohio State, and one loose year when my dad was stationed at Wright-Patt when I was a kid, preschool.
When did you realize that Ohio was going to be your home, and it felt like the place you were going to be what you are?
Probably a couple of years into teaching at Cincinnati, after, you know, graduate school life is a kind of a peripatetic life, and so you're moving every 2 years or so. And I did that for a long time, but after I'd been at Cincinnati 3 or 4 years, you look up and you go, hey, this is home.
Angela, you were born in Alabama, but you grew up in Ohio.
Oh, yeah. Basically, the story goes, my father came to Ohio first looking for a job, the early 60s. When he finally found a job, he sent for my mother. So she got on a Greyhound bus with me. When he showed up to pick her up, I guess he'd been gone a couple of months, and I stared at him like I didn't know him. At this point, I was a toddler. And my mother said, in a few seconds, I climbed on his lap, and they basically had to pull me off of him while he was driving. You know, that was pre-car seat.
Right.
So, and then I was an Ohioan, and I've been here ever since, although much as I love Ohio, I am constantly going back to Alabama because I have a lot of family there. And sure. I take it, once you leave Alabama but you've been born there, you always belong to them. So I have this wonderful place where I'm definitely an Ohioan, but my place of birth loves me too.
Like double citizenship or dual
definitely.
Citizenship.
So I can run from one place to the other. You know,
that's not so bad.
The weather.
Do both places inspire you as a writer?
Both of them definitely do. I used a lot of the geography where I grew up in Ohio in my books, but everything always seems to point south. My first novel, the protagonist actually was running from the south in the early 60s, and I'm always, you know, notating something from my home. So, and I actually based a book of poetry in Alabama. So, it stays with you.
David Catro, how about you? Are you a homegrown Buckeye?
No, I'm not. I'm not sure exactly where I'm from. I was born in Virginia and moved after I was born. About 2 years into it, we moved back to Michigan. My dad was in the Army, and he wasn't military, but I know exactly what Andrew's talking about, being sort of blown to the four winds. Wherever your family goes, you follow, obviously. And we moved many times. I probably moved maybe 11 times by the time I was graduating from high school. So I kind of grew up with this attitude. It's sort of Pavlovian. I I get nauseous when I smell a new shirt because it tells me that I'm going to start a new school. And I'm going to be the.
And they had to dress you up to do this?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, oh, sure. And they're always these sort of loud plaid pants, sans a belt, and the nice button down shirt, and the cool shoes, the X15 shoes, black. And that's kind of how I grew up.
It's funny you bring up what the Pavlovian response is. I grew up, yeah. I moved around a lot too, and for me it's the cardboard boxes, the smell of those. I remember climbing all over them the first time I remember moving. But you live in Springfield now.
I live in Springfield now, and I worked as an editorial cartoonist since 1984. And I think the Bush administration pretty much did me in. I got some really good cartoons out of it, but took a lot out of me. It was kind of like reading the newspaper as an editorial cartoonist. You have to kind of cull this thing in the morning, this monster. And I always felt like I was kind of infecting myself with some sort of intestinal parasite, and then I'd have to, I would get rid of it through this biting cartoon, and then I'd sleep well that night. And then I'd have to get up in the morning and do it all over again. And so gladly, about 2 years ago, I was able to leave cartoons and, for the readers that disagreed with a lot of the things that I did, their advice to me was put a sock in it, kind of thing. Got an opportunity to be screamed at by a lot of interesting people. But I jumped full both feet into books. That's where I felt like my gifts and my happiness lie.
Yeah, well, so. I have a 27-year background in newspapers, and boy, yeah, the hate mail. That was, or let's see, how else could we put it? Just the advice you get from readers, like put a sock in, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. Very, very different.
Very constructive.
It does bring up that issue, though. Do you hear from readers very often when you do what you do? Andrew, do you get feedback from readers?
Not so much. Poetry magazines tend to have a fairly small circulation, but poems that are in anthology sometimes get responses. So I get calls from, I get emails from kids. I have a poem in which when I was a kid, my uncle's well had started smelling bad at about the same time that the neighbor's dog went missing. And my uncle put a rope around my cousin and lured him into the well to pull up this dead dog. And I wrote about this as if it had happened to me. And it's in some high school and textbooks. And so in the spring, when kids get to that, I get kind of frantic emails from kids wanting me to assure them that the dog lived through this process. And I have to explain, no, I'm sorry.
Here go the smell.
we don't get a happy ending on this one.
Oh, gee. What about you, Angela? You write for young people.
Most of what I get is fan mail. Mm-hmm. By the time kids are in high school, you rarely get letters from them. And they tend, of course, to be fans, but they're a little bit more critical of your work than, elementary age children.
They're just critical in general, has been my experience.
And actually, it's kind of fun. When you do get a critical letter, it's kind of fun because there's a, I go back and forth and I do write them back. And, I love the idea that somebody's paying attention. I've written almost 40 books. They cannot all possibly be good and have worked for everyone. So it's kind of fun to get a snarky teenager in there, and to tell you you blew it. I love that. It keeps you on your toes. But the little ones are wonderful. They see things in your book that even when you've written them and they've been sitting on a bookshelf for years that you just never saw before. So that's kind of fun.
That must be what one of the wonderful things about writing a book, especially, or poetry that's going to be out there for the ages. And now, David Catrow, you've got your series on Mack Spaniel. And have you heard from children about these yet?
Oh, sure. In contrast to Andrew's story about the well, my stories all end happily, like a Lassie episode.
Well, I don't know about that. They end happily, though.
Everything ends up, it wraps up in a nice, neat little bow, and it's happy all around. So, I do hear from people. I have people that will write me, and I thought once I left cartooning, it would all be positive stuff, but then I started hearing from people about a book that I had illustrated a couple of years ago with Mike Reese called The Boy Who Looked Like Lincoln.
Yes.
And I said that somebody asked me what book I had coming out, and she asked me, oh, what's coming out? And I said, it's called The Boy Who Looked Like Lincoln. She goes, oh, what's that about?
The boy who looked like Lincoln.
Well, it's about this boy, and he's got an early beard. But the very, very last page, Mike Reese is, if you're familiar with his humor, he used to write for The Simpsons. His humor and my humor seemed to mesh just perfectly, and he was able to, I think, anticipate some of the things that I would do, and I really understood his words, and I really jumped at this story at the very, very end. It was this this kid. He looks like Lincoln, and it's this problem that he has because, you know, he looks like Lincoln, and nobody else does, really.
Except for
maybe Lincoln, the penny. And so he works it out, and he's happy about everything. He loves, you know, his own unique qualities, and he ran for class president, won overwhelmingly, and then the only really issue that he had was his little brother Dickie, and then the very last picture was there was like the coup de grace, it's French, and it was this little kid, his little brother looks just like Richard Nixon. And, you know, I
thought you said they all end happily.
This one did. I think this little kid eventually comes to terms with that, too. But I'd never been cartooning when Nixon was actually president. I was just watching him on television with my mom listening to the Watergate, mm-hmm. you know, hearings, all that stuff. So I never really got an opportunity to cartoon him when he was president. But afterwards, I would look for every lame reason I could to draw Richard Nixon. I said, oh, this is my chance. I've got this opportunity in a book to actually draw Richard Nixon as a baby. And I had a little Fisher-Price tape recorder. But the thing that I didn't realize was that, you know, Nixon's ski jump nose, you know, her block did remarkable job drawing him. But I failed to anticipate what this little cartoon baby would look like painted flesh tones. And we started getting really, you know, outraged letters from people about this very last picture. And I don't want to go any more graphic than that, but okay. It was.
Okay, that's, what are we going to do, folks? We're going to run out and check out that book. Right?
So I did. I thought I left that behind when I finished cartooning, but people are there waiting to jump on you.
We have to take a short break, and then we'll get back to all of this with our three authors, Angela Johnson, David Catro, and Andrew Hudgens. They are featured at the Ohioana Book Festival this weekend. If you want a link, it's ohioanabookfestival.org, and you can go to wosu.org/allsides for that link and to learn more about what is happening at this free event. We'll be right back with All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News.
Today is the last day for the opportunity to shorten the WOSU Spring Membership Drive by one day. If we raise $20,000 by tonight, we'll take tomorrow off, meaning you'll get more of the radio you rely on. But right now, we're relying on you. Make your pledge to wosu.org/pledgefree. It's fast and easy and will help us reach our overall goal of $175,000. Go online right now and help get more radio. That's wosu.org/pledgefree. And it's 74 degrees in downtown Columbus. Sunshine today, a high right around 82. Clouds move in tonight, bringing a chance of rain, maybe a thunderstorm, a low of 53. For Thursday, sunshine and a high of 73 degrees. All Sides with Ann Fisher continues. This is WOSU 820 NPR News. Thanks for joining us.
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. We're talking with three featured authors, poets, for the 4th Annual Ohioana Book Festival. It'll be held at the State Library of Ohio on Saturday from 10 a.m. to 4:30 p.m. It's free and open to the public. It includes readings, panel discussions, book appraisals, children's activities, and a book fair. For more, you can go to the website. We'll have a link to that on WOSU.org/allsides. What do you do at the Ohioana Book Festival? Anyways, what are you going to do, Angela?
It seems we're going to be jacks of all trades. I'm going to the Columbus School for Girls, and they're actually feeding me, which I love.
That's always good.
I love any time anyone feeds me.
Mm-hmm.
I will be speaking to, I believe, a 5th and 6th grade class. They picked a book of a book that I put a short story in, and they'd like me to read that to them. I believe I'm going to be on some panels on Saturday, do some readings. So it sounds like fun. You know, normally I'm just at schools and speaking to librarians. So this is a little different for me. I'm actually, mostly I'm talking to children. I actually have to be an adult now, which is problematic sometimes for me.
It's all relative, though.
It's all relative, though. I mean, I think I can make the jump to adulthood.
What about you, Andrew? You are usually speaking with college students. Who do you speak to at something like this?
I was actually at the festival last year. I'm promoting a book called Shut Up, You're Fine, Poems for Very, Very Bad Children.
Oh.
And none of those poems end happily, by the way. And it's beautifully illustrated by Barry Moser. But anyway, I was there promoting that book, and You do panels, so people can come and ask questions at the panel. We'll all be doing readings from our work at some time. And mostly you're sitting at a desk behind a pile of books, and people come up and you sign them for them. So it gives you a chance to talk to tons of people and gives people, you know, you're sitting there, so people just come up and talk to you. So it's a great place for that. If you want to meet the people who wrote the books that you like or pick up the books that they've written, it's a great place to meet folks. And also they've got all kinds of, people dressed up like cartoon characters and things like that. So it's a great place for kids. And I remember last year AEP was giving out little foam baseballs, and I was collecting them and throwing them at friends as they walked by. So there's lots of ways to have fun.
So it's kind of loosey-goosey.
Yeah,
it's not
absolutely.
All uptight, you know, literary snobbiness or anything like that.
Not at all.
Okay. David, what are you going to do there?
I believe there's a panel discussion. Mentors
about?
And Muse, I think that might have been the one that I was going to be placed on, and just sort of talking about the process of writing and the process of illustrating. And, I try to, as much as I can, actually let people, as far as I could go, get into my head a little bit and find out how I work. And, you know, we were talking earlier about talking to the dogs. I think that's a real important, at least for me, that's a really important part of doing what I do, is I can, I talk to our dogs. I talk to the animals, and I know that probably sounds kind of freaky.
Not to somebody like me. I say, excuse me to my dog.
Yeah, but there's just this, you sort of sense a soul, I guess, in these creatures, and I sense this energy, and it, no matter where I'm at and who I'm actually talking to, I'm using my two first fingers there to mm-hmm. put the
quotation.
Quotes.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, talking to. But, you know, I want people to understand that this is not some sort of magic that I'm doing, that we're doing. There's a process that we go through that over the years you just sort of hone and refine. And so hopefully I can, get that information out to people so that, because I think that's what people wonder about more than anything else. you know, how you come up with these ideas and where they come from. And I, as a kid, I wasn't the sharpest sandwich in the drawer, I guess. I just assumed books were sort of made. But I never had a chance to actually talk to an author or an illustrator before. And so I'm going to be talking to schools, and there's several schools that are coming over to the library to watch me draw and read and talk about my characters. And
I don't know about you guys, but creative writing, poetry, creative writing is so much more emphasized now than it was when I was growing up in grade school in the 60s. Do you agree?
Yeah. I agree. I've gone to classrooms where I'll sit down and start talking, and all of a sudden three or four children will raise their hands and say, you know, I've got this novel. We're talking junior high here.
Right.
I've got this 300-page novel I'm working on. It blows me away. I mean, I heard 300-page novel when I was in college. You know, the idea that these kids are at this level, I mean, I'm not saying that they're ready to be published or anything, but the idea that they've even written something with 300 pages, I mean, I'm sorry, I've been published, and none of my novels have ever been over 140 pages.
But that's part
not
of your art, yeah.
Right, not that more is necessarily
right,
better.
Right.
But it amazes me, and they know so much more than I did when I was a kid. And I, too, believed, you know, when I was a small child, that books just were sort of made, and I had no idea how they came to fruition. So they're very on it now. Someone is doing something right.
You, Andrew, you mentor college students, poets. I was wondering, you know, for me, I was pretty messed up by the whole Anne Frank thing, that this 14-year-old prodigy produced these incredible documents. And I was lucky enough last fall to interview Francine Prose, who's written an entire book about the fact that, no, she didn't just write them off the top of her head. She edited them several times and intended them to be public. You know, a big part of, you know, what you do as a writer, what anyone does is if they're good, is self-edit.
Absolutely. When I was a kid, I didn't even think that books were made. They just seemed to exist.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they seemed like magic. And I didn't start thinking about what it would mean to be, a writer until well into high school, and then I started simply playing around with pushing words around poorly. But one of the things that you learn quickly is that you have to be bad to be good. You've got to start. You've got to start at a place where you're not good to make something that's good. And that's true today. I was talking to my wife, who's working on another one of her novels. Same thing. The first draft's job is to be bad so that it will exist, and then you can move on to the next one. And at Ohio State, we have a large creative writing program that's very good, and we have wonderful undergraduates and graduate students. And it's exciting to see people, you know, with the really smart students, you're not even teaching them so much as pointing them. You know, read this and think about it. Read this and think about this part of it. And people, you know, all writers are at some level autodidacts, because all, you know, 99% of the work is when you're at home alone in a
right.
room with the door closed and your butt in a chair.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, David.
Well, I wanted to kind of speak on what Angela just talked about. You know, a kid coming up in junior high and talking about this 300-page novel. That, you know, for that kid to do that, it's, you know, somewhere along the line, whether it's a teacher or a parent, has inspired that kid to think that that's accessible, that that's something that they have the potential to do if they work at it. I go back to before I even became a cartoonist, I was sort of contemplating being a cartoonist. And I went and visited, I had been doing cartoons, but I was never syndicated. I visited Tony Auth at the Philadelphia Inquirer. And I remember going into his office and seeing this pile of, you know, up to his belly button, he had a pile of cartoons that he had done. And I went in, and one of the first things that went through my head was, oh, my God, there's no way I'm ever going to be able to do that. And but I loved it. I loved it so much. I loved talking about issues and expressing my opinion. I just sort of jumped in and started doing it. But what I quickly realized was I was accumulating a pile, too. That sounds kind of like a sounds like a health show here. I was accumulating a pile of stuff, you know, cartoons, a body of work that if you can get a kid to start that early enough, they start seeing the potential then, because it wasn't until I started accumulating this stuff and had a sort of an artist's perspective on my work and what I wanted to say and what I'd said in the past. I think we've done something right with some of these programs that are in the schools now, the reading programs and the writing programs. And, you know, Andrew, you're probably seeing the fruits of those now with the students that you're mentoring.
Absolutely. And I just was at a Poetry Out Loud competition over at Ohio Dominican, and it was terrific to see these kids come in from all over the state that had memorized poems, and they were working with their English teachers and their theater teachers and were reciting them, complicated poems at a really gorgeous level. I was blown away.
That's so wonderful for the kids on so many levels. I just want to remind the listeners that this is All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820. My guests are Andrew Hudgens, poet and OSU English professor, Angela Johnson, children's author, and David Catro, author and illustrator of the series, the new series. There's two books. Does that make a series, or do we need three?
There'll be more to come, but these are the first two.
Okay, yeah. About Max Spaniel. The whole idea of reciting it out loud, you know, reciting it, saying it out loud, is something relatively new too, and which reminds me that I wanted you to read something, if you don't mind.
Well, thank you,
Andrew.
I'd love to. In honor of spring, I was one of those gardeners who spent more time looking into the compost bin than I did, you know, actually gardening. And so I wrote an ode to compost, and the poem is called Compost, an Ode, and it takes its epigraph from the book of Job. Who can bring a clean thing out of an unclean? The beauty of the compost heap is not the eye's delight. Eyes see too much. They see blood-colored worms and bugs so white they seem to feed off ghosts. Eyes do not see the heat that shimmers in the moist heart of decay, in its unmaking, making fire, just hot enough to burn itself. In summer, the heap burns like a stove. It can almost hurt you. I've held my hand inside the fire and counted 1, 2, 3, 4. I cannot hold it there. Give it to me, the heat insists. It's mine. I yank it back and wipe it on my jeans as if I'd really heard the words. And eyes cannot appreciate sweet vegetable rot. How good it smells as everything dissolves, dispersing back from thing into idea. From our own table, we are feeding it what we don't eat, orange rind and apple core, corn husks, and odds and ends the children smear across their plates. We feed them all into the slow, damp furnace of decay. Leaves curled edges, buckle, collapsing down into their centers, as everything turns loose its living shape and blackens, gives up what it once was to become dirt. The table scraps and leafage join, indistinguishable, the way that death insists it's all the same, while life must do a million things at once. The compost heap is both life, death, a slow simmer, a leisurely collapsing of the thing into its possibilities, both bean and hollyhock, potato, zinnia, squash, the opulence of everything that rots.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You don't need an illustrator.
No, not at all.
You captured that.
I see it.
Well, thank you.
Oh,
thank you.
It's wonderful.
Yeah, talk about taking something from a thing to an idea. Yeah, I read that earlier this morning when I was on my way back home after running an errand. I kept thinking about the composter, and it's time to get it going now. Where it's all starting over again. It's so very cyclical. at least as far as making the turns are.
Absolutely.
We have a call from Joe. He wants to talk about writing in undergrad. Joe, are you undergrad at OSU?
Hi there. Yes, at OSU. I'm an older undergrad. I'm 30. I'm now 39.
You sound very young.
Yeah. Yeah, so young 39, I hope. I wanted to say, the creative writing program at Ohio State is wonderful. And that I had, when I took class, I resisted some of the things I was being taught. And the one main thing I resisted that ended up being wonderful for me in my writing was that she had told me that I had written something about the character. He grinned suspiciously, and she had said, "No, you just say he grinned." And I just was like, "What is she talking about? You know, how else I put across, you know, that it was a suspicious grin?" And then she was able to explain to me, you have to set up the context that he's suspicious and acting suspiciously, and then you say he grinned. And I remember thinking that doesn't make sense, but then how that opened up my writing, I was able to think of a lot of things that way as I was describing things, not to be too verbose with just the description in one line of an individual and their behavior, but instead to set up that how you want that person's personality to come across to the reader in the rest of the context, and then you just show his behavior as raw as you can. And that just really opened up my writing. I thought that was wonderful.
You know, Angela, that appealed to me very much in your book that I read, Sweet Hereafter, how there were just little bits and pieces of people. But when you looked at it as a whole, there was the context.
Yeah, I always go by, I try to follow the rule, less is more. You know, it's the things that are unsaid and the small tidbits that you drop along the way that make the context. You know, I tend to want to say less, and in the end, the big picture needs to come out then. You know, basically all my writing career, I've been looking for ways to say less and in the end say more. So it's studied, you know, there's a lot. In the beginning, there wasn't as much editing because I believe that's just the way I thought. Mm-hmm. But as I get older, I find I have to edit myself more. I don't know what that means, but, you know, I always believe the things left unsaid end up meaning
more. That opened up my writing so much. And if I can make one other comment of something I learned very much in the creative writing program is not to underestimate, not that the program does, is the teaching of, you know, Edgar Allan Poe's writings, things like that. Because even as an adult at my age, I'm a jack of all trades. I've gotten into a lot of things. I read a lot of books when I was a kid, but just not the cultural books. And I was introduced to that for the first time. At age 37, and just absolutely became addicted. And it just is, you know, like I said, it's a, you know, a lot of people might think that, you know, well, it's just the same thing, you know.
No, now you make me want to go and grab my
yes,
you know, and
exactly.
Read it now.
Exactly. And, you know, never underestimate the influence and the power that can have on a student, even one that's 37 years old taking the class.
Bravo.
Thank you, Joe.
Absolutely. All right,
thank you.
We have to take another short break, and I want to come back. That was a wonderful thought by Joe, and I'd like to talk about it some more with Andrew Hudgens, poet and OSU English professor, Angela Johnson, children's author, and David Catrow, author and illustrator. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News. The next Fresh Air, Burt Bacharach and Hal David talk about writing songs for their 1968 musical, Promises, Promises. The Broadway revival opened last week. Also, why do people hoard, and at what point does hoarding become a pathology? We talk with the authors of the new book, Stuff. Join us. And Fresh Air begins in 20 minutes. It starts at noon right here on WOSU 820, NPR News. Join WOSU Public Media for PubCamp Ohio, a free one-day unconference on public media and social media. It's Saturday, May 8th from 8:30 until 4 at WOSU Ecosi. Meet community technology activists, citizen journalists, and public broadcasters in an engaging, collaborative environment.
For registration and more information, follow us on Twitter at PubCampOhio or click on the PubCamp link at WOSU.org.
Support for WOSU comes from Tech Columbus, presenting the 2010 Innovation Summit on May 27th. Executives and industry thought leaders will explore new thinking about innovation and leadership. More at TechColumbusInnovationSummit.com.
75 degrees in downtown Columbus, sunshine today and a high around 82. Clouds tonight and a chance of rain, a low of 53. All Sides with Ann Fisher continues. This is WOSU 820 NPR News.
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Angela, I'm sorry you can't be with us during the breaks.
Oh, I'm sorry too.
Yeah, they're always kind of fun. Oh. We were talking about continuing the conversation that we were having with Joe, the caller, about the idea of editing, and what that means, and also the context of something and how important that is. And I was wondering if David Catro could tell us how he edits as an illustrator.
You know, growing up really as an artist in newspapers, I think I learned lessons that maybe a lot of traditionally trained or educated writers learn. They were more of a practical kind of – I had an editor that I'll never forget. He said I had done a cartoon that was particularly mean and that morning, and, you know, I was anticipating people – screaming at me, and he said before we even gotten a call that morning, he said, "Don't ever apologize, you know, just tell them why, but never apologize." And I thought that was seemed kind of, you know, kind of callous to not apologize. You know, when you've wronged someone, you feel humanly, you feel like you need to apologize, make your amends to them. And so I said, "Okay, sure." And I never did. I explained where I was coming from. But those kinds of lessons. One of the others was, you know, look for your words. I mean, you've only got so much space to – you can't be, you know, doing, you know, a novel in a bubble. It's got to be something that you sit there and you choose words that carry as much weight – and as much power as you possibly can, and you craft these balloons so that you can get the biggest bang for your buck. And so, you know, a lot of my time, you know, if I had a bubble, a lot of my time was spent going, okay, what's a funnier car than a Mercury? You know, Mercuries aren't funny cars. Buicks. Now that's a funny car. You know. But I think that sort of carried through. One of the other lessons I learned was if you draw for yourself or you write for yourself, you're writing for the largest audience. And I don't know if you kind of use something like that in your teaching. But you know, I think I buy into that totally because I've read writers that look like, that sound like they're not having a whole lot of fun. They're not loving what they're doing. And, you know, I love what I'm doing, and I love to show people that I love what I'm doing. And I think people can see that. They can feel that energy coming from the printed page. And I think a lot of, you know, Angela, her writing, you feel that. You feel her emotional attachment to these characters and this place that she's created. She's there. She's living it. And Andrew, what you were talking about, you know, what you were reading, the compost thing, the white bugs that looked like they were feeding off ghosts. I mean, that there's an energy there, and people, they understand that.
Mm-hmm,
you know,
mm-hmm. I agree absolutely. Yeah.
You want to find the words that express the message in a way that will reach the most people.
Exactly, and you do that by. A considerable level pleasing yourself. I mean, we kind of integrate a sense of what an audience is into ourself. But if you just write for an imagined audience, you're going to be selling yourself out, and you're going to be doing, you know, you're absolutely right, things you don't care about.
Exactly. You know, as writers, you know, it's true. You sit in a house, You're on your butt. You're with me. I'm in my pajamas three quarters of the time.
All right.
But yeah, you know, you got to have the pajamas on.
Yep.
And when I'm not writing, I'm, you know, watching children's television, which is the furthest thing, you know, from making me creative, actually. It's just something that I can just sit and watch. And I worry sometimes that you worry that you're just writing for yourself. And I think it's an ongoing, it's sort of an ongoing problem with me that I have to always strive. I have to not become so egocentric that I believe that everything you wrote before, you know, is going to stand because, you know, you're only as good as your next work, you know, and you have to attach significance to the fact that you are writing for a market that's changing. And even though teens have been who they are forever, you know, the cultural aspect of everything changes. And you really want to not have, you know, a 16-year-old open the book and go, wow, you know, here's a 48-year-old woman wrote this book. She totally doesn't understand me.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a fear, but I think it's a healthy fear. So, you know, I cling to it because it makes me better and it makes me sort of expand my vision about the audience I'm writing for.
You know, I read about your writing style. It is sort of like a sense of multitasking. There's a lot going on, and as we spoke of earlier, very few words.
Yes, yes. I think I've sort of become the master of that. I don't know. When you're in the and when you're surrounded by teenagers, I've always been amazed, again, by the unsaid. You know, the knowing looks, you know how you are with your friends. If you're in a room full of adults, teenagers tend to get quieter, you know.
Yeah.
And it's all of the looks and the unseen things that they say to each other through, I don't know, whatever I remember how I basically dealt with my friends. But I have to remember those things even in the writing, you know, because they don't always tell the story. Even if they're dealing with their friends, there's always a level of privacy. You know, there's always holding back. Their psyches are always holding something back. And I think that's so important to remember.
So it makes how you hold back, as far as the story goes, relatable to them. They get
exactly.
That. They get that way of communicating.
They do get that. And I hope they continue to get that. And I think I'm doing it right, and I hope I'm doing it right because, you know, these books aren't for me. You know, and when it becomes about me, it's time for me to be a welder, which, by the way, I wanted to be, too, so, you know, because I thought that was creative also. So, you know, it's time to do something else if you're not moving a universal audience. It really is.
Andrew, how do you visualize who you're speaking with?
You know, I don't know that I do much anymore. I used to think a lot about an audience, but after a while I think that kind of becomes an integrated part of your psyche. And to a certain extent, you're writing to make it right. You're writing for not really yourself, but your sense of what it is that makes it a finished, accomplished, complicated work of art. And I say that, but at the same time, these are, I hope, very clear, very accessible poems. That's the kind of poem I like to read, Robert Frost, and poems that the complexities are in the material, not in figuring out what the poem is saying.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. Exactly. I know what you're talking about, and what am I going to learn through this?
Exactly.
It's not... Zach, I know it's the compost
exactly.
We're talking about.
Yeah, yeah.
But what am I going to learn from having that conversation?
Exactly.
What am I going to learn from having you talk about it or write about it or that sort of a thing?
Now, I just want to stop and ask, Angela, we're dressed up. You're not in your pajamas now.
Oh,
are you?
I'm sorry, guys. Yes, I am.
Get up and put on clean shirts.
A late morning cup of coffee in my PJs.
Ooh,
yes.
I envy you.
Oh, man.
Yes,
yeah. You could run all day without saying that. I just so the listeners know, I wanted Angela to read, but she's got the allergies. So
I
didn't want people to...
I'm afraid of the sneezing and the coughing, Jay.
Well, you know, I just wanted to let folks know. And David, do you read your books?
Yeah, I do. You mean...
Out loud?
To an audience?
Right.
Who can't see the pictures?
Right, that's the problem.
I thought about that, and I thought, well, this is kind of this is kind of good because no one has the ability to see the pictures, so they can use the words and imagine for themselves what this could.
Well, then read some from Funny Lunch, because I didn't get a chance to look at that. And what more pleasure could you have with a book than to have the author reading it to you and. Let everyone else out there imagining the photo. You know, the pictures, should be said, they're very, what I would think of as very comical, very fun, very sweet and cuddly. And it's all the, right down to the little red tummy on the dog. But you give them tummy rubs. You just want to go up and give Max a tummy rub.
Yeah, well, that was the effects of his allergies, too.
Okay.
He was actually on Benadryl for a while because of the pink belly. This is a book called Funny Lunch, and this is you have to say the name of the book. I thought maybe I should sing it, maybe read it in an English accent because it would give the words more import. This is Funny Lunch, Max Spaniel Funny Lunch.
Okay.
My name is Max. I am not a dog. I am a great chef. My great, 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 great grandpa, Axe Spaniel, was a chef. When I get dressed, I have to look just right. No, this is kind of surreal. No, yes. We wash our paws before we work. We make the special of the day, pizza pie. We roll, we pat, we toss. We put the pizza pie in the oven. Lunch is busy. A tummy growls. I growl back. Everyone's hungry. Welcome to Max's. Would you like to try the special? No, thank you, he says. Chili for me. So I bring him a scarf. This will warm you up, I say. Welcome to Max's. Would you like to try the special? No, thank you, she replies. I will have a hot dog. So I bring her a hot dog. I sing, I dance, I do a little magic. I hear the takeout bell. The driver barks, 100 pizzas with everything. Yippee! We roll. We mix. We bake. Oh, no, it is not a pizza pie. It is a pizza mess. What are we going to do? This is not Dickens. A great chef thinks on his feet. We race to Joe's Pizza Palace. We race back with a leaning tower of pizzas. Pizzas for everyone, and a pizza party for us. The end.
It's so different to just have it read.
It really is. And I have to interject, the illustrations in this book are hysterical.
They are.
Absolutely hysterical.
Oh, thank you.
You just want to go up and give him a
hug.
I was looking over David's shoulder as he was reading, and absolutely, the illustrations are worth the price of, you know, twice the price.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
They're very complex. The expressions on Max's face are wonderful. Now, how much does your dog actually, how much does Bubs actually inspire these books?
Oh, he has. He started showing up in my books way back. Well, he was born in 1997. And so a couple years after that, he started creeping into my work. And he actually started showing up in my books on a regular basis back in 2000. So that was 10 years ago. And he just crept in. It was just something – there was something about the Springer Spaniel, if anybody knows what a Springer Spaniel looks like, there's something you sort of lock into that that pattern, those the two, that white flare that goes down the center of the face, and the two black areas where the eyes kind of shine through.
Well, the eyes.
And they, you know, he's very much with me. I see him in my sleep. And I had an editor that just called me, Grace Macarone, who called me just out of the blue. I'd never worked with her before, and she, I saved the voicemail on my cell phone, and she said, "Hi, this is Grace Macarone, and I'd like to know if you wanted to call me sometimes. We could talk about Bubs." And I'm going, "Bubs? You know, I mean, nobody ever." Editors that I've worked with have never called me up to talk about my dogs. There's always some other, more, you know, a bigger reason for them wanting to talk. But she was seeing him showing up in my books, and she's the one that suggested this this series. And it's just something I love. I mean, I love drawing him. I've drawn him thousands of times, and I do quite literally see him in my sleep.
Does he ever smile?
Yeah, he does. Yeah. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. What inspires you, Andrew?
Getting up and going to work every morning. You know, inspiration is mostly just getting to work. The as to what actually gets into my head when I'm sitting there, a little of anything, mm-hmm. things that I've seen, things that I've been thinking about, phrases that you get stuck in your head, the things that you don't understand. You're walking across campus, you're walking the dog, you see something. And so you then start thinking about it. What does it mean? And I'll give you an example. One day I was walking the dog and a biscuit fell in the street in front of me. Frozen biscuit. I don't know where it came from. I sat there and I thought, is somebody shooting biscuits out of a potato cannon? Is, you know, I mean, there was no building it could have been thrown from. So here I am in one of these unexplained mysteries of the universe. So, but it was the form of a frozen biscuit. Well, you know, I had to think about that for a good little while. I took this frozen biscuit home, put it on the kitchen counter, and just left it there for about a week until my wife made me throw it away. And, but, so anyway. So it could be anything.
It could be anything.
Was that the end of the dinosaurs, the frozen?
When the frozen biscuits started falling on them, yeah.
Was it excavated first and then tossed?
Gluten. By who knows?
Yeah. The first gluten. We have to call it a day now with my guests, Andrew Hudgens, poet, NOSU English professor. Andrew, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
And also Angela Johnson, children's author. Her latest is The Sweet Hereafter. Angela,
thank you.
Thank
you for having me on.
I should mention as well, Andrew's latest collection of poems is called American Rendering. It's of new and selected poems. And also David Catro, author, illustrator, author of the new series on Max Spaniel, the latest being Funny Lunch. Thanks, David, for joining us today.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. Find out about the Ohioana Book Festival at WOSU.org/allsides. It's all day Saturday, and it's free. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820. This is listener-supported WOSU and WOSU HD 820 Columbus, and streaming on the web at WOSU.org, WOSU 820, NPR News.